them shouting and happy, and most of them drunk. After they had eaten, Hymir drained the last of the beer from his drinking cup and called for silence. Then he handed the cup to Thor.
"Smash it," he said. "Smash this cup, and the cauldron in which I brew my beer is yours as my gift to you. Fail, and you die."
Thor nodded. The giants stopped their joking and their songs. They watched him warily. Hymir's fortress was built of stone. Thor took the drinking cup, hefted it in both hands, then threw it with all his might against one of the granite pillars that held up the roof of the banqueting hall. There was an ear-splitting crash, and the air was filled with blinding dust. When the dust settled, Hymir got up and walked over to what was left of the granite pillar. The cup had gone through first one pillar, then another, breaking them into tiny fragments of stone. In the rubble of the third pillar was the drinking cup, a little dusty but quite undamaged. Hymir held his drinking cup above his head, and the giants cheered and laughed and made faces at Thor with all their heads, along with crude gestures. Hymir sat down at the table once more.
"See," he said to Thor, "I didn't think you were strong enough to break my cup."
He held up the cup, and his wife poured beer into it. Hymir slurped the beer.
"Best beer you will ever taste," he said. "Here, wife, pour more beer for your son and for his friend Vior. Let them taste the best beer there is, and be sad that they will not be taking my cauldron home with them, and that they will never again taste beer this good. Also, they will be sad that I need to kill Vior now, for my cup remains unbroken."
Thor sat at the table beside Tyr, and picked up a lump of charred whale meat, and chewed it resentfully. The giants were raucous and loud, and now were ignoring him. Tyr's mother leaned over to fill Thor's cup with beer. "You know," she said quietly, "my husband has a very hard head. He's stubborn and thick-skulled."
"They say the same of me," said Thor.
"No," she said, as if she were talking to a small child. "He has a very hard head. Hard enough to break even the toughest of cups." Thor drained his beer. It really was the best beer he had ever tasted. He stood up and walked over to Hymir.
"Can I try again?" he asked.
The giants in the hall all laughed at this, and none of them laughed louder than Hymir.
"Of course you can," he said.
Thor picked up the drinking cup. He faced the stone wall, hefted the cup once, twice, then turned swiftly on his heel and smashed the cup down on Hymir's forehead. The fragments of the cup fell one by one onto Hymir's lap. There was silence in the hall then, a silence broken by a strange heaving noise. Thor looked around to see what the noise was, and then he turned back and saw Hymir's shoulders shaking. The giant was crying in huge heaving sobs.
"My greatest treasure is no longer mine," said Hymir. "I could always tell it to brew me ale, and the cauldron itself would magically brew the finest beer. Never again will I say, 'Brew me ale, my cauldron.'"
Thor said nothing. Hymir looked at Tyr and said bitterly,
"If you want it, stepson, then take it. It's huge and heavy. It takes over a dozen giants to lift it. Do you think you were strong enough?"
Tyr walked over to the cauldron. He tried to lift it once, twice, but it was too heavy even for him. He looked at Thor. Thor shrugged. grasped the cauldron by the rim and flipped it so he was inside it, and the handles clattered at his feet. Then the cauldron began to move, with Thor inside. It headed toward the door, while all around the hall many-headed giants stared, open-mouthed. Hymir no longer wept. Tyr glanced up at him. "Thank you for the cauldron," he said, and then, keeping the moving cauldron between himself and Hymir, Tyr edged out of the room. Thor and Tyr left the castle together, untethered Thor's goats, and climbed into Thor's chariot. Thor still carried the cauldron on his back. The goats ran as best they could, but while Snarla ran well and ran fast, even with the weight of the giant's cauldron to pull, Grindr limped and staggered. Its leg had once been broken for marrow, and Thor had set it, but the goat had never been as strong again. Grindr bleated in pain as it ran.
"Can't we go any faster?" asked Tyr. "We can try," said Thor, and he whipped the goats, so they ran even faster.
Tyr looked behind.
"They are coming," he said. "The giants are coming."
They were indeed coming, with Hymir at their rear, urging them on, all the giants of that part of the world, a many-headed monstrous bunch, the giants of the waste, misshapen and deadly, an army of giants all intent on getting their cauldron back.
"Go faster," said Tyr.
It was then that the goat called Grindr stumbled and fell, throwing them out of the chariot. Thor staggered to his feet. Then he threw the cauldron to the ground and began to laugh.
"What are you laughing about?" asked Tyr. "There are hundreds of them."
Thor hefted Mjolnir, his hammer.
"I didn't catch and kill the serpent," he said. "Not this time. But 100 giants almost make up for it."
Methodically, enthusiastically, one after the next, Thor killed the giants of the waste, until the earth ran black and red with their blood. Tyr fought one-handed, but he fought bravely, and he slew his share of giants that day. When they were done, and all the giants were dead, Thor crouched beside Grindr, his injured goat, and helped it back to its feet. The goat limped as it walked, and Thor cursed Loki, whose fault it was that his goat was lame. Hymir was not among the slain, and Tyr was relieved, for he did not want to bring his mother any additional distress. Thor carried the cauldron to Asgard, to the meeting of the gods. They took the cauldron to Eir.
"Here," said Thor, "a brewing cauldron big enough for all of us."
The sea giant sighed.
"It is indeed what I ask for," he said. "Very well. There will be an autumn feast for all the gods in my hall."
He was as good as his word, and since then, every year, once the harvest is in, the gods drink the finest ale there ever was or will be in the autumn in the sea giant's hall. The Death of Balder. 1. Nothing there is that does not love the sun. It gives us warmth and life. It melts the bitter snow and ice of winter. It makes plants grow and flowers bloom. It gives us the long summer evenings when the darkness never comes. It saves us from the bitter days of midwinter when the darkness is broken for only a handful of hours and the sun is cold and distant, like the pale eye of a corpse. Balder's face shone like the sun. He was so beautiful that he illuminated any place he entered. Balder was Odin's second son, and he was loved by his father and by all things. He was the wisest, the mildest, the most eloquent of all the Aesir. He would pronounce judgment, and all would be impressed by his wisdom and his fairness. His home, the hall called Breithablik, was a place of joy and music and knowledge. Balder's wife was Nanna, and he loved her and only her. Their son, Forseti, was growing up to become as wise a judge as his father. There was nothing wrong with Balder's life or his world, save only one thing. Balder had bad dreams. He dreamed of worlds ending, and of the sun and the moon being eaten by a wolf. He dreamed of pain and death without end. He dreamed of darkness, of being trapped. Brothers slew brothers in his dreams, and nobody could trust anyone else. In his dreams, a new age would come upon the world, an age of storm and of murder. Balder would wake from these dreams in tears, troubled beyond all telling. Balder went to the gods, and he told them of his nightmares. None of them knew what to make of the dreams, and they too were troubled. All but one of them. When Loki heard Balder talk of his bad dreams, Loki smiled. Odin set out to find the cause of his son's dreams. He put on his grey cloak and his broad-brimmed hat, and when folk asked his name, he said he was Wanderer, son of Warrior. Nobody knew the answers to his questions, but they told him of a seer, a wise woman, who understood all dreams. She could have helped him, they said, but she was long dead. At the end of the world was the wise woman's grave. Beyond it, to the east, was the realm of the dead who had not died in battle, ruled over by Hel, Loki's daughter, by the giantess Angarbotha. Odin travelled east, and he stopped when he reached the grave. The Allfather was the wisest of the Aesir, and he had given his eye for more wisdom. He stood by the grave at the end of the world, and in that place he invoked the darkest of runes, and called on old powers long forgotten. He burned things, and he said things, and he charmed, and he demanded. The storm wind whipped at his face, and then the wind died, and a woman stood before him on the other side of the fire, her face in the shadows. "It was a hard journey, coming back from the land of the dead," she told him. "I've been buried here for such a long time. Rain and snow have fallen on me. I do not know you, man who raised me. What do they call you?" "They call me Wanderer," said Odin. "Warrior was my father. Tell me the news from Hel." The dead wise woman stared at him. "Balder is coming to us," she told him. "We are brewing mead for him. There will be despair in the world above, but in the world of the dead there will be only rejoicing." Odin asked her who would kill Balder, and her answer shocked him. He asked who would avenge Balder's death, and her answer puzzled him. He asked who would mourn Balder, and she stared at him across her own grave, as if she were seeing him for the first time. "You are not Wanderer," she said. Her dead eyes flickered, and there was expression on her face. "You are Odin, who was sacrificed by himself to himself so long ago. And you are no wise woman. You are she who was in life Angarbotha, Loki's lover, mother to Hel, to Jormungandr, the Midgard serpent, and to Fenris Wolf," said Odin. The dead giantess smiled. "Ride home, little Odin," she told him. "Run away, run back to your hall. No one will come to see me now until my husband, Loki, escapes from his bonds and returns to me, and Ragnarok, the doom of the gods, tearing all asunder, approaches." And then there was nothing in that place but shadows. Odin left with his heart heavy, and with much to think about. Even the gods cannot change destiny. And if he was to save Balder, he would have to do it with cunning, and he would need help. There was one other thing that the dead giantess had said that disturbed him. Why did she talk about Loki escaping his bonds? Wondered Odin. Loki is not bound. And then he thought, not yet. 2. Odin kept his own counsel. But he told Frigg, his wife, mother of the gods, that Balder's dreams were true dreams, and that there were those who meant their favorite son harm. Frigg thought. Practical as ever, she said, I do not believe it. I shall not believe it. There is nothing that despises the sun and the warmth and the life it brings the earth, and by the same token there is nothing that hates my son, Balder the Beautiful. And she set out to ensure that this was so. She walked the earth and exacted an oath from each thing that she encountered never to harm Balder the Beautiful. She spoke to fire, and it promised it would not burn him. Water gave its oath never to drown him. Iron would not cut him, nor would any of the other metals. Stones promised never to bruise his skin. Frigg spoke to trees, to beasts, and to birds, and to all things that creep and fly and crawl, and each creature promised that its kind would never hurt Balder. The trees agreed, each after its kind, oak and ash, pine and beech, birch and fir, that their wood could never be used to hurt Balder. She conjured diseases and spoke to them. And each of the diseases and infirmities that can hurt or wound a person agreed that it too would never touch Balder. Nothing was too insignificant for Frigg to ask, save only the mistletoe, a creeping plant that lives on other trees. It seemed too small, too young, too insignificant, and she passed it by. And when everything had sworn its oath not to harm her son, Frigg returned to Asgard. Balder is safe, she told the Aesir. Nothing will hurt him. All of them doubted her, even Balder. Frigg picked up a stone and whipped it toward her son. The stone skipped around him. Balder laughed with delight, and it was as if the sun had come out. The gods smiled. And then one by one they threw their weapons at Balder, and each of them was astonished and amazed. Swords would not touch him, spears would not pierce his flesh. All the gods were relieved and happy. There were only two faces in Asgard that were not radiant with joy. Loki was not smiling or laughing. He watched the gods hack at Balder with axes and with swords, or drop enormous rocks on Balder, or try to strike Balder with huge knotted wooden clubs, and laugh as the clubs and swords and rocks and axes avoided Balder, or touched him like gentle feathers. And Loki brooded, and slipped away into the shadows. The other was Balder's brother Hod, who was blind. "What is happening?" asked blind Hod. "Will somebody please tell me what is happening?" But nobody talked to Hod. He listened to the sound of merrymaking and joy, and he wished he could be a part of it. "You must be very proud of your son," said a kindly woman to Frigg. Frigg did not recognize the woman, but the woman beamed when she looked at Balder, and Frigg was indeed proud of her son. Everybody loved him after all. "But won't they hurt him, the poor darling, throwing things at him like that? If I were his mother, I would be afraid for my son." "They will not hurt him," said Frigg. "No weapon can hurt Balder. No disease, no rock, no tree. I have taken an oath from all the things there are that can harm." "That's good," said the kindly woman. "I'm pleased. But are you sure you didn't miss any of them?" "Not a one," said Frigg. "All the trees. The only one I did not bother with was the mistletoe. It's a creeper that grows on the oak trees west of Valhalla. But it's too young and too small ever to do any harm. You could not make a club from mistletoe." "My, my," said the kindly woman. "Mistletoe, eh? Well, truth to tell, I wouldn't have bothered with that either. Much too weedy. The kindly woman had begun to remind Frigg of someone. But before the goddess could think who it was, Tyr held up an enormous rock with his good left hand, held it high above his head, and crashed it down on Balder's chest. It disintegrated into dust before ever it touched the shining god. When Frigg turned back to talk to the kindly woman, she was already gone, and Frigg thought no more about it. Not then. Loki, in his own form, travelled to the west of Valhalla. He stopped by a huge oak tree. Here and there, pendulous clumps of green mistletoe leaves and pale white berries hung from the oak, seeming even more insignificant when seen next to the grandeur of the oak. They grew directly out of the bark of the oak tree. Loki examined the berries, the stems, and the leaves. He thought about poisoning Balder with mistletoe berries, but that seemed too simple and straightforward. If he was going to do harm to Balder, he was going to hurt as many people as possible. 3. Blind Hod stood to one side, listening to the merriment and the shouts of joy and astonishment coming from the green, and he sighed. Hod was strong, even if he was sightless, one of the strongest of the gods, and usually Balder was good about making certain that he was included. This time even Balder had forgotten him. "You look sad," said a familiar voice. It was Loki's voice. "It's hard, Loki. Everyone is having such a good time. I hear them laughing. And Balder, my beloved brother, he sounds so happy. I just wish I could be part of it." "That is the easiest thing in the world to remedy," said Loki. Hod could not see the expression on his face, but Loki sounded so helpful, so friendly, and all the gods knew that Loki was clever. "Hold out your hand." Hod did so. Loki put something into it, closed Hod's fingers around it. "It is a little wooden dart I made. I will bring you close to Balder, and I will point you at him, and you shall throw it at him as hard as you can. Throw it with all your might. And then all the gods will laugh, and Balder will know that even his blind brother has taken part in his day of triumph." Loki walked Hod through the people, toward the hubbub. "Here," said Loki, "this is a good place to stand. Now, when I tell you, throw the dart." "It is only a little dart," said Hod wistfully. "I wish I were throwing a spear or a rock." "A little dart will do," said Loki. "The tip of it is sharp enough. Now throw it there, like I told you." A mighty cheer and a laugh. A club made of knotted thornbush wood, studded with sharp iron nails, was swung by Thor into Balder's face. The club skipped up and over his head at the last moment, and Thor looked as if he were dancing. It was very comical. "Now," whispered Loki. "Now, while they are all laughing." Hod threw the dart of mistletoe, just as he had been told. He expected to hear cheers and laughter. Nobody laughed, and nobody cheered. There was silence. He heard gasps and a low muttering. "Why is nobody cheering me?" asked Blind Hod. "I threw a dart. It was neither big nor heavy, but you must have seen it. Balder, my brother, why are you not laughing?" He heard wailing then, high and keen and awful, and he knew the voice. It was his mother who wailed. "Balder, my son! Oh, Balder! Oh, my son!" she wailed. It was then that Hod knew his dart had hit home. "How terrible, how sad! You have killed your brother," said Loki. But he did not sound sad. He did not sound sad at all. 4. Balder lay dead, pierced by the mistletoe dart. The gods gathered, weeping and tearing their garments. Odin said nothing, save only, "No vengeance will be taken on Hod. Not yet, not right now, not at this time. we are in a place of holy peace. Frigg said, Who among you wants to win my good graces by going to hell? Perhaps she will let Balder return to this world. Even hell could not be so cruel as to keep him. She thought for a moment. Hel was, after all, Loki's daughter. And we will offer her a ransom to give us Balder back. Is there one of you who is willing to travel to Hel's kingdom? You might not return. The gods looked at each other, and then one of them raised his hand. This was Hermod, called the Nimble, Odin's attendant, the fastest and the most daring of the young gods. I will go to Hel, he said. I will bring back Balder the Beautiful. They brought forth Sleipnir, Odin's stallion, the eight-legged horse. Hermod mounted it and prepared to ride down, ever down, to greet Hel in her high hall, where only the dead go. As Hermod rode into darkness, the gods prepared Balder's funeral. They took his corpse, and they placed it on Hringhorn, Balder's ship. They wanted to launch the ship and burn it, but they could not move it from the shore. They all pushed and heaved, even Thor, but the ship sat on the shore unmoving. Only Balder had been able to launch his ship, and now he was gone. The gods sent for Hyrrokin, the giantess, who came to them riding on an enormous wolf with serpents for reins. She went to the prow of Balder's ship, and she pushed as hard as she could. She launched the ship, but her push was so violent that the rollers the ship was on burst into flame, and the earth shook, and the waves were terrifying. I ought to kill her, said Thor, still stinging from his own failure to launch the ship, and he grasped the handle of Mjolnir, his hammer. She shows disrespect. You will do nothing of the kind, said the other gods.
I'm not happy about any of this, said Thor. I'm going to kill somebody soon, just to relieve the tension. You'll see.
Balder's body was brought down the shingle, borne by four gods. Eight legs took him past the crowd assembled there. Odin was foremost in the crowd of mourners, his ravens on each shoulder, and behind him the Valkyries and the Aesir. There were frost giants and mountain giants at Balder's funeral. There were even dwarfs, the cunning craftsmen from beneath the ground, for all things that there were mourned the death of Balder. Balder's wife, Nanna, saw her husband's body carried past. She wailed, and her heart gave out in her breast, and she fell dead onto the shore. They carried her to the funeral pyre, and they placed her body beside Balder's. Out of respect, Odin placed his arm ring, Draupnir, onto the pyre. This was the miraculous ring made for him by the dwarves Brokk and Eitri, which every 9 days would drip eight other rings of equal purity and beauty. Then Odin whispered a secret into Balder's dead ear, and what Odin whispered, none but he and Balder will ever know. Balder's horse, fully caparisoned, was ridden to the pyre and sacrificed there in order that it would be able to bear its master in the world to come. They lit the pyre. It burned, consuming the body of Balder and the body of Nanna and his horse and his possessions. Balder's body flamed like the sun. Thor stood in front of the funeral pyre, and he held Mjolnir high.
I sanctify this pyre, he proclaimed, darting grumpy looks at the giantess Hyrrokin, who still did not, Thor felt, appear to be properly respectful.
Lit, one of the dwarfs, walked in front of Thor to get a better view of the pyre, and Thor kicked him irritably into the middle of the flames, which made Thor feel slightly better, and made all the dwarfs feel much worse.
I don't like this, said Thor testily. I don't like any of it one little bit. I hope Hermod the Nimble is sorting things out with Hel. The sooner Balder comes back to life, the better it will be for all of us.
5. Hermod the Nimble rode for 9 days and 9 nights without stopping. He rode deeper, and he rode through gathering darkness, from gloom to twilight to night to a pitch-black starless dark. All that he could see in the darkness was something golden glinting far ahead of him. Closer he rode, and closer, and the light grew brighter. It was gold, and it was the thatch of the bridge across the Gjalla River, across which all who die must travel. He slowed Sleipnir to a walk as they crossed the bridge, which swung and shook beneath them. "What is your name?" asked a woman's voice. "Who are your kin? What are you doing in the land of the dead?" Hermod said nothing. He reached the far end of the bridge, where a maiden stood. She was pale and very beautiful, and she looked at him as if she had never seen anything like him before. Her name was Malfgoth, and she guarded the bridge. "Yesterday, enough dead men to fill 5 kingdoms crossed this bridge, but you alone cause it to shake more than they did, though there were men and horses beyond all counting. I can see the red blood beneath your skin. You are not the color of the dead. They are gray and green and white and blue. Your skin has life beneath it. Who are you? Why are you traveling to hell?" "I am Hermod," he told her. "I am a son of Odin, and I'm riding to hell on Odin's horse to find Baldur. Have you seen him?" "No one who saw him could ever forget it," she said. "Baldur the Beautiful crossed this bridge 9 days ago. He went to Hell's Great Hall." "I thank you," said Hermod. "That is where I also must go." "It is downward and northward," she told him. "Always go down and keep traveling north. You will reach Hell's Gate." Hermod rode on. He rode northerly, and he followed the path down until he saw before him a huge high wall and the gates to Hell, which were higher than the tallest tree. Then he dismounted from his horse, and he tightened the girth strap. He remounted, and holding tight to the saddle, he urged Sleipnir faster and faster, and at the last it leapt a jump like no horse has made before or since, and it cleared the gates of Hell and landed safely upon the other side in Hell's domain, where no living person can ever go. Hermod rode to the great hall of the dead, dismounted, and walked inside. Baldur, his brother, was seated at the head of the table at the seat of honor. Baldur was pale. His skin was the color of the world on a gray day, when there is no sun. He sat and drank the mead of Hel, and ate her food. When he saw Hermod, he told him to sit beside him and spend the night with them at the table. On the other side of Baldur was Nanna, his wife, and next to her, and not in the best of tempers, was a dwarf called Lit. In Hel's world, the sun never rises, and the day can never begin. Hermod looked across the hall, and he saw a woman of peculiar beauty. The right side of her body was the color of flesh, but the left-hand side of her body was dark and ruined like that of a weak old corpse that you might find hanging from a tree in the forest or frozen into the snow, and Hermod knew that this was Hel, Loki's daughter, whom the Allfather had set to rule over the lands of the dead. "I have come for Baldur," said Hermod to Hel. "Odin himself sent me. All things there are mourn him. You must give him back to us." Hel was impassive. One green eye stared at Hermod, and one sunken dead eye. "I am Hel," she said simply. "The dead come to me, and they do not return to the lands above. Why should I let Baldur go?" "All things mourn him. His death unites us all in misery, god and frost giant, dwarf and elf. The animals mourn him, and the trees, even the metals, weep. The stones dream that brave Baldur will return to the lands that know the sun. Let him go." Hel said nothing. She watched Baldur with her mismatched eyes, and then she sighed He is the most beautiful thing, and I think the best thing ever to come to my realm. But if it is truly as you say, if all things mourn Baldur, if all things love him, then I will give him back to you."
Hermod threw himself at her feet.
"That is noble of you. Thank you, great queen." She looked down at him.
"Get up," she said.
"I have not said I will give him back."
"This is your task, Hermod.
Go and ask them.
All the gods and the giants, all the rocks and the plants, ask everything. If all things in the world weep for him and want him to return, I will give Baldur back to the Aesir and the Day. But if one creature will not cry or speaks against him, then he stays with me forever."
Hermod got to his feet. Baldur led him from the hall, and he gave Hermod Odin's ring, Draupnir, to return to Odin as evidence that Hermod had been to Hel. Nanna gave him a linen robe for Frigg and a golden ring for Fulla, Frigg's handmaiden. Lit just grimaced and made rude gestures. Hermod clambered back on Sleipnir. This time the gates of Hel were opened for him as he left, and he retraced his steps. He crossed the bridge, and eventually he saw daylight once again. In Asgard, Hermod returned the arm ring Draupnir to Odin, the Allfather, and told him all that had happened and all that he had seen. While Hermod was in the underworld, Odin had had a son to replace Baldur. This son, named Vali, was the son of Odin and the goddess Rind. Before he was a day old, the baby found and slew Hod. So Baldur's death was avenged. 6. The Aesir sent messengers across the world. The messengers of the Aesir rode like the wind, and they asked each thing they encountered if it wept for Baldur, so that Baldur could be free of Hel's world. The women wept, and the men, the children, and the animals. Birds of the air wept for Baldur, as did the earth, the trees, the stones, even the metals the messengers encountered wept for Baldur in the way that a cold iron sword will weep when you take it from the freezing cold into the sunlight and warmth. All things wept for Baldur. The messengers were returning from their mission, triumphant and overjoyed. Baldur would soon be back among the Aesir. They rested on a mountain, on a ledge beside a cave, and they ate their food and drank their mead, and they joked and they laughed.
"Who is that?"
called a voice from inside the cave, and an elderly giantess came out. There was something vaguely familiar about her, but none of the messengers was entirely certain what it was.
"I am Thuk," she said,
which means gratitude.
"Why are you here?"
"We have asked each thing there is, if it would weep for Baldur, who is dead. Beautiful Baldur, killed by his blind brother. For each of us misses Baldur as we would miss the sun in the sky were it never to shine again, and each of us weeps for him." The giantess scratched her nose, cleared her throat, and spat onto the rock.
"Old Thuk won't weep for Baldur," she said bluntly. "Alive or dead, old Odin's son brought me nothing but misery and aggravation. I'm glad he's gone. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Let Hel keep him."
Then she shuffled back into the darkness of her cave and was lost to sight. The messengers returned to Asgard and told the gods what they had seen, and that they had failed in their mission, for there was one creature that did not weep for Baldur, and did not want him to return, an old giantess in a cave on a mountain. And by then they had also realized who old Thuk reminded them of. She had moved and talked much like Loki, the son of Loive.
"I expect it was really Loki in disguise," said Thor. "Of course it was Loki. It's always Loki.
Thor hefted his hammer, Mjolnir, and gathered a group of the gods to go looking for Loki, to take their revenge. But the crafty troublemaker was nowhere to be seen. He was hiding, far from Asgard, hugging himself in glee at his own cleverness, and waiting for the fuss to die away. The Last Days of Loki. 1. Balder was dead, and the gods were still mourning his loss. They were sad, and the grey rains fell unceasingly, and there was no joy in the land. Loki, when he returned from one of his journeys to distant parts, was unrepentant. It was the time of autumn feast in Eir's hall, where the gods and elves were gathered to drink the sea giant's fresh-brewed ale, brewed in the cauldron Thor had brought back from the land of the giants so long ago. Loki was there. He drank too much of Eir's ale, drank himself beyond joy and laughter and trickery, and into a brooding darkness. When Loki heard the gods praise Eir's servant, Fimafeng, for his swiftness and diligence, he sprang up from the table and stabbed Fimafeng with his knife, killing him instantly. The horrified gods drove Loki out of the feast hall, into the darkness. Time passed. The feasting continued, but now it was subdued. There was a commotion at the doorway, and when the gods and goddesses turned to find out what was happening, they saw that Loki had returned. He stood in the entry to the hall staring at them, with a sardonic smile on his face. "You are not welcome here," said the gods. Loki ignored them. He walked up to where Odin was sitting. "Allfather, you and I mixed our blood long, long ago, did we not?" Odin nodded. "We did." Loki smiled even more widely. "Did you not swear back then, great Odin, that you would drink at a banqueting table only if Loki, your sworn blood brother, drank with you?" Odin's good grey eye stared into Loki's green eyes, and it was Odin who looked away. "Let the wolf's father feast with us," said Odin gruffly, and he made his son Vidar move over to make room for Loki to sit down beside him. Loki grinned with malice and delight. He called for more of Eir's ale and gulped it down. One by one, that night, Loki insulted the gods and the goddesses. He told the gods that they were cowards, told the goddesses that they were gullible and unchaste. Each insult was woven with just enough truth to make it wound. He told them that they were fools, reminded them of things they thought were safely forgotten. He sneered and jeered and raised old scandals and would not stop making everyone there miserable until Thor arrived at the feast. Thor ended the conversation very simply. He threatened to use Mjolnir to shut Loki's evil mouth for good and send him to hell, all the way to the Hall of the Dead. Loki left the feast then, but before he swaggered out, he turned to Eir. "You brewed fine ale," said Loki to the sea giant, "but there will never be another autumn feast here. Flames will take this hall. Your skin will be burned from your back by the fire. Everything you love will be taken from you. This I swear." And he walked away from the gods of Asgard, into the dark. 2. Loki sobered up the next morning and thought about what he had done the night before. He felt no shame, for shame was not Loki's way, but he knew that he had pushed the gods too far. Loki had a home on a mountain near the sea and decided to wait there until the gods had forgotten him. He had a house on the top of the mountain with 4 doors, one on each side, allowing him to see danger coming toward him from any direction. During the day, Loki would transform himself into a salmon, and he would hide in the pool at the bottom of Fraunang's Falls, a high waterfall that tumbled down the mountainside. A stream connected the pool to a little river, and the river led directly to the sea. Loki liked plans and counterplans. As a salmon, he was fairly safe, he knew. The gods themselves could not catch salmon as they swam. But then he began to doubt himself. He wondered, could there be a way of catching a fish in the deep waters of the pool beneath the waterfall? How would he, the craftiest of all, the most cunning planner, catch a salmon? Loki took a ball of nettle yarn, and he began to knot and weave it into a fishing net, the first such net ever to be made. Yes, he thought, if I used this net, I could catch a salmon. Now, he thought, to work out a counterplan, what will I do if the gods weave a net like this one? He examined the net he had made. He thought, salmon can jump, he thought. They can swim upstream, even travel up waterfalls. I could jump over the net. Something drew his attention. He peered out from first one door and then another. He was startled. The gods were coming up the mountainside, and they had almost reached his house. Loki flung the net into the fire and watched it burn with satisfaction. Then he stepped into Fraunang's Falls. In the shape of a silver salmon, Loki was swept over the waterfall, and he vanished into the depths of the deep pool at the base of the mountain. The Æsir reached Loki's house on the mountain. They waited by each door, cutting off Loki's escape if he was still inside. Kvasir, wisest of the gods, walked in through the first door. Once he had been dead, and mead had been brewed from his blood. But now he was alive once more. He could tell from the fire and from the half-drunk cup of wine beside it that Loki had been there only moments before he arrived. There was no clue to where Loki could have gone, though. Kvasir scanned the sky. Then he looked down at the floor and at the fireplace.
"He's gone, the sniveling little weasel," said Thor, coming in through another of the four doors. "He could have transformed himself into anything. We'll never find him."
"Do not be so hasty," said Kvasir. "Look."
"It's only ashes," said Thor.
"But look at the pattern of it," said Kvasir. He bent down, touched the ash on the floor beside the fire, sniffed it, then touched it to his tongue. "It is the ash of a cord that has been thrown into the fire and burned, cord just like that ball of nettle twine in the corner." Thor rolled his eyes.
"I do not think that the ashes of a burned cord are going to tell us where Loki is."
"You think not? But look at the pattern, a criss-cross diamond shape, and the squares are perfectly regular."
"Kvasir, you are wasting all our time admiring the shapes that the ash makes. This is foolishness. Every moment we spend staring at the ash is time in which Loki is getting farther and farther away."
"Perhaps you are right, Thor. But to make the squares in the cord that regular, you would need something to space them with, like that piece of scrap wood on the floor by your foot. You would need to tie one end of the cord to something as you wove it, something like that stick jutting from the floor over there. Then you would knot and thread your rope, weaving it so that one piece of cord would form a... I wonder what Loki called it. I will call it a net."
"Why are you still jabbering?" said Thor. "Why are you staring at ash and at sticks and scraps of wood when we could be chasing Loki? Kvasir! As you ponder and talk your nonsense, he is getting away from us."
"I think that such a net as this would be best used to trap fish," said Kvasir.
I am done with you and your foolishness.
Sighed Thor.
So it's to be used to trap fish. Well, bully for you. Loki would have been hungry, and so he must have wanted to catch fish to eat. Loki invents things. That's what he does. He always was clever. That's why we used to keep him around.
You are correct. But ask yourself, why would you, if you were Loki, invent something to trap fish with, and then throw the net you made onto the fire when you knew we were coming?
Because,
said Thor, creasing his brow and pondering so hard that distant thunder could be heard in the mountaintops. Exactly, because you would not want us to find it when we arrived, and the only reason for not wanting us to find it is to stop us, the gods of Asgard, from using it to trap you. Thor nodded slowly.
I see, he said.
Then,
yes, I suppose so, he said.
And finally,
so Loki
is hiding in the deep water pool at the foot of the waterfall in the shape of a fish. Yes, exactly. I knew you would get there in the end, Thor. Thor nodded with enthusiasm, not entirely certain how he had come to this conclusion from ashes on the floor, but happy to know where Loki was hiding.
I will go down there to the pool with my hammer, said Thor, and
We will need to go down there with a net, said Kvasir, the wise god. Kvasir took the remaining nettle twine and the piece of spacing wood. He tied the end of the twine to the stick, and he began to wrap the twine around the stick, to weave it in and around and through. He showed the other gods what he was doing, and soon each of them was weaving and knotting. He attached the nets they made, one to the other, until they had a net as long as the pool, and they made their way down the side of the waterfall to the base of the mountain. There was a stream that ran out of the pool where it overflowed. That stream ran down toward the sea. When they reached the base of Fraunang's Falls, the gods unrolled the net they had made. The net was huge and heavy and long enough to go from one end of the pool to the other. It took all the warriors of the Aesir to hold up one end of it, and Thor to hold up the other end. The gods started from one end of the pool, beginning immediately underneath the falls, and wading until they reached the other side. They caught nothing.
There's definitely something living down there, said Thor. I felt it push against the net, but it swam down deeper into the mud, and the net went over it.
Kvasir scratched his chin thoughtfully. Not a problem. We need to do it again. But this time we will weigh down the bottom of the net, he said, so nothing can get underneath it. The gods gathered heavy stones with holes in them and tied each stone to the bottom of the net as a weight. The gods waded into the pool again. Loki had been pleased with himself the first time the gods had entered his pool. He had simply swum down to the muddy bottom of the pool, slipped between two flat stones, and waited while the net had gone above him. Now he was worried. Down in the dark and the cold, he thought about this. He could not transform himself into something else until he left the water. And even if he did, the gods would be after him. No, it was safer to remain in salmon shape. But as a salmon, he was trapped. He would have to do what the gods would not be expecting. They would expect him to head for the open sea. He would be safe there if he got to the sea, even if he would be easy to spot and catch in the river that led from the pool to the bay. The gods would not expect him to swim back the way he had come, up the waterfall. The gods hauled their net along the bottom of the pool. They were intent upon what was happening in the depths, and so were taken by surprise when a huge silver fish, bigger than any salmon they had ever seen before, leapt over the net with a twist of its tail and began swimming upstream. The huge salmon swam up the falls, springing up and defying gravity as if it had been thrown upward into the air. Kvasse shouted at the Aesir, ordering them to form into two groups, one on one end of the net, one on the other. "He will not stay in the waterfall for long. It's too exposed. His only chance is still to make it to the sea. So you two groups will walk along, dragging the net between you. Meanwhile, Thor," said Kvasir, who was wise, "you will wade in the middle. And when Loki tries that jumping over the net trick again, you must snatch him from the air, like a bear catching a salmon. Do not let him go, though. He is tricky." Thor said, "I have seen bears pluck leaping salmon from the air. I am strong, and I am as fast as any bear. I will hold on." The gods began to drag the net upstream, toward the place where the huge silver salmon was biding its time. Loki planned and plotted. As the net came closer, Loki knew that this was the critical moment. He had to leap the net, as he had done before, and this time he would race toward the sea. He tensed, like a spring about to whip back, and then he shot into the air. Thor was fast. He saw the silver salmon glitter in the sun, and he grabbed it with his huge hands, just as a hungry bear snatches a salmon from the air. Salmon are slippery fish, and Loki was the slipperiest of salmon. He wriggled and tried to slip through Thor's fingers, but Thor simply gripped the fish harder and squeezed it tightly down by the tail. They say that salmon have been narrower near the tail ever since. The gods brought their net, and they wrapped it tightly around the fish and carried it between them. The salmon began to drown in the air, gasping for water, and then it thrashed and twitched, and now they were carrying a panting Loki. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Where are you taking me?" Thor just shook his head and grunted and did not reply. Loki asked the other gods, but none of them would tell him what was happening, and none of them would meet his eye. 3. The gods entered the mouth of a cave, and with Loki slung between them, they went down deep into the earth. Stalactites hung from the ceiling of the cave, and bats fluttered and flickered. They went down lower. Soon the way was too narrow to carry Loki, and now they let him walk between them. Thor walked immediately behind Loki, his hand on Loki's shoulder. They went down a long, long way. In the deepest of the caves, there were brands burning, and three people stood there, waiting for them. Loki recognized them before he saw their faces, and his heart sank. "No," he said, "do not hurt them. They did nothing wrong." Thor said, "They are your sons and your wife, Loki Liesmith." There were three huge flat stones in that cave. The Aesir set each stone on its side, and Thor took his hammer. He broke a hole through the middle of each stone. "Please, let our father go," said Narfi, Loki's son. "He is our father," said Vali, Loki's other son. "You have sworn oaths that you will not kill him. He is a blood brother and an oath brother to Odin, highest of the gods." "We will not kill him," said Kvasir. "Tell me, Vali, what is the worst thing that one brother could do to another?" "For a brother to betray his brother," said Vali, without hesitating. "For a brother to murder a brother, as Hod killed Baldur. This is abominable." Kvasir said, "It is true that Loki is a blood brother to the gods, and we cannot kill him. But we are bound by no such oaths to you, his sons." Kvasir spoke words to Vali, words of change, words of power. Vali's human shape fell from him, and where Vali had stood was a wolf, foam flecking its muzzle. The intelligence of Vali was fading from its